Call of Love, written by Barbara Cartland, narrated by Anthony Wren. Chapter 1, 1880. Lord Kennington woke with a start and remembered that he was at sea. He had been very tired when he came aboard the P&O liner, which was taking him to India. After eating a supper brought to his cabin by his valet, he had climbed into bed. He knew that he had a great deal to think about and decide on when he was alone, but instead he had fallen asleep. Now, as he glanced at the clock beside him, he saw that it was well into a new day. He had been extremely busy before he had come on board. The Prime Minister had asked him if he would go out to India and bring back to him a personal report on the situation on the frontier of that country. India was of huge importance to Great Britain, and there was an unmistakable menace from the Russians. The Cossacks, riding magnificently across southern Asia, were coming nearer and nearer to what was always considered the brightest jewel in the British crown. Queen Victoria herself had told Lord Kennington that she wanted a much more intimate report than she had been currently receiving, and the Prime Minister had spent several hours discussing his mission with him. Now, having rung for his valet, Lord Kennington got up and began to dress, having decided that he would go down to breakfast rather than have it in his cabin. He had made it a rule never to talk while he was dressing. He always disliked chatter early in the morning, and his valet therefore handed him his clothes one by one without saying a word. Then he walked out and onto the deck for a little fresh air before he went to the saloon for breakfast. They were a long way down the English Channel, and he realized they would soon be in the Bay of Biscay, which was invariably rough, however bright the sunshine. He was an excellent sailor. A rough sea did not worry him. In fact, he rather enjoyed it. As he walked round the deck, he thought by the time he reached India he would be sadly short of exercise. In London, he would normally ride his exceedingly fine horses in Rotten Row early in the morning, and when he was in the country, he had an early breakfast so that he could ride for at least 2 hours before he started work. He should, at the age of 28, have been enjoying himself, like most of his friends, with the beauties in Mayfair, who were hotly pursued by the Prince of Wales. Lord Kennington had, however, found recently that, however beautiful a woman might be, in a short while she became boring. Although it might seem absurd, he really preferred working to making love. This suited the Prime Minister and the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, who both regularly consulted him on various matters of state. If there was trouble in Paris, it was said almost automatically. "Oh, send Kennington over to see what is wrong." And then the Prime Minister would insist that the same rule applied to most other countries in Europe. He had inherited his brain and air of authority from a long line of impressive ancestors who had played their part in English politics from the moment they were born. When Lord Kennington's father died and he came into the title, there was no doubt that young Charles was a chip of the old block. At Eton, he had always been top of the class, and at Cambridge University he had been awarded a first. "The trouble with you, Charles, is that you have too many brains for your age," one of his friends said to him. "You make us all feel stupid, and we naturally resent it." Lord Kennington had smiled, but did not reply, and he knew only too well that his friends would be more than willing to accept his many invitations to shoot, to hunt, and to take part in the steeplechase that was one of the great events in the spring. At his home, which was one of the finest ancestral houses in the whole of England, everything ran perfectly, like clockwork. He was not required to give very much personal attention to it, and this left him free for the political and diplomatic world in which he had made his name. Invariably, he was involved in every crisis, whether it happened in London, Europe, or Timbuktu. His mother had been delighted when he told her that he was going to India. "Whether you like it or not, dearest Charles," she said, "you will have a rest on the way out."